I call it okay.
Case number 08-5494, Richard Miller, appellant, versus Mark V. Rosenker, acting chair, National Transportation Safety Board. Mr. Young for appellant, Mr. Hudak for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is David Young of Arnold & Porter, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Miller, in this appeal. We request reversal of the District Court's decision dismissing Mr. Miller's claims of discrimination based on non-selection for two positions, as well as separate actions that led to a reduced performance evaluation. The District Court erred in dismissing Mr. Miller's case for failure to respond to the NTSB's dispositive motion. When the record plainly shows that his 24-page opposition submission directly and adequately addressed the submissions that the agency made, the arguments they made in their briefing. And this is true for three reasons. First, with respect to Mr. Miller's non-selection claims, and that's counts one and two, the district court erred because Mr. Miller disputed the relevant facts that the agency contended were undisputed regarding when he first sought EEO counseling. And this is the district court erred in two regards. First, with respect to the budget officer sex discrimination claim, which is count one, Mr. Miller alleged, and the NTSB did not contest, that he was not aware that a female had been selected for that position until approximately December of 2001. So therefore, even accepting the agency's argument that Mr. Miller did not seek EEO counseling until January 2nd of 2002, it was undisputed that Mr. Miller had no reasonable basis to conclude, or to suspect discrimination until December 2001.
Do you understand the government's argument implicitly to be that because he knew he had not been selected, he had a duty to inquire as to who had been?
Well, I think it's undisputed that Mr. Miller did inquire as to who had been selected and was told that that information could be made available to him, but the record does not indicate when the information actually became available. He certainly suspected that, he certainly believed that he was qualified for the position and asked, inquired as to why he was not selected, and then was told reasons for that, which he contends were not accurate, and at some point in the future became aware of the information regarding who actually was selected. And since then, it's undisputed that Mr. Miller was not aware of that fact until December 2001. That's less than 45 days prior to the date that the NTSB contends he actually did initiate EEO counseling. There's a second and independent reason why the district court erred with respect to the non-selection claims, and that's because Mr. Miller disputed that he did not initiate EEO contact until until January of 2002. NTSB admittedly has no records regarding when Mr. Miller first initiated EEO contact. Its employees do not recall when Mr. Miller first initiated EEO contact, but the NTSB's EEO director estimated that contact was no earlier than January 2nd of 2002, and her estimate was based on the fact that she requested an EEO counselor for Mr. Miller on January 8th, 2002, and it was her, quote, standard practice to initiate such a request within several days of an employee contacting her. Mr. Miller, however, directly disputed that Ms. Guest followed this practice in his case. He submitted a declaration from himself and several coworkers indicating that he first initiated contact with Ms. Guest beginning in April of 2001, which was...
Do you think there's a difference between talking to Farrah Guest, you know, and saying I'm unhappy and I think there are some problems here, and actually saying I feel like I've been discriminated against and I want to have access to a counselor?
The language that's in the I think there is a distinction between those two. I don't think this court has addressed specifically what level of contact is required. Mr. Miller indicated that he thought that he was qualified for these positions, and he initiated discussions with Ms. Guest regarding
But as I understand the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think that he says something like, she goes to work there in March, and he says, I started talking to her in April, and we had these discussions from April through December, correct?
Yes.
But he's not, there were other non-selections, there were other things that he was concerned about, so these conversations were obviously about other things. So how do we know when that became a serious conversation that I believe that I've been discriminated against and I'm seeking recourse?
Well, two things with respect to that. I mean, his declaration does say that he was frustrated that that Ms. Guest was not moving forward with his requests throughout the period following his initial contact in terms of assigning him a counselor. But it is imprecise as to when he exactly said, I would like a counselor. The second point is that in a case like this where, one, the NTSB and Mr. Miller are so far apart as with respect to when that contact began, and two, there's no discovery in the case whatsoever regarding what that contact initially looked like, what kind of discussions he had, any depositions of Ms. Guest or anything like that, and then the district court grants a motion for summary judgment. Those are issues that are a little ambiguous on the record and certainly would have been fleshed out had discovery been permitted. Mr. Miller also stated in his declaration that he couldn't recall precise information regarding his initiation of contact with Ms. Guest and that information that would be relevant to that was contained in his calendar and email and notes that were at the NTSB and that he had not been allowed access to. Which is another reason why, in this sort of case, without any discovery having taken place at the time the district court issues its decision, Mr. Miller's lack of precision with respect to the exact factual scenario for his initiation of contact is understandable given his request for this information and the fact that it hasn't been made available to him.
Well, now the government says, NTSB says, that there are a couple of places where they argue Mr. Miller actually conceded that the date of contact was November 2nd, and they cite a couple places in the record where that appears to be the case. So is your position that January 2nd is the date, or that we don't know and he's not acknowledging that?
No, our position is that that Mr. Miller initiated contact with Ms. Guest beginning in April of 2001, and that was initially with respect to the count two position, the special assistant position, and then those discussions continued and were also taking place then in November or December 2001 after he became aware of who was selected for the count one position. So we don't contend that we just don't know when it was. With respect to whether Mr. Miller conceded when contact began, the two specific instances, and I think this is addressed in our reply brief, but the two specific instances that NTSB raises, the language, one is from the EEO decision, and another is from a declaration or a complaint, another complaint that Mr. Miller had filed. And the language that's actually used there is with respect to the EEO counselor, and it's undisputed that Mr. Miller didn't actually speak with an EEO counselor until December of 2002, after the NTSB, after Ms. Guest, submitted the order on January 8th, and the actual investigation began.
So there's no concession. You're saying, in context, those statements are not a concession.
That's correct, because the statements acknowledge that Mr. Miller's contact with the counselor didn't begin until January, and the issue that's in dispute is when Mr. Miller's contact with the EEO director to begin the process, since at the NTSB there are no counselors on staff. The EEO director has to order a counselor once the discrimination claim is made. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Hudak.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Hudak from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the appellee, the chairman of the NTSB, who is now Deborah Hurstman. The appellee asks you to affirm the district court's decision. The district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing count three as The plaintiff did not offer any argument as to the grounds for dismissal of that claim, and the district court correctly determined that plaintiff did not timely initiate EEO counseling for the two non-selections at issue in count one and count two. To begin with, regarding count one, I think looking at the standard for when the EEO exhaustion clock begins is important. It is the employer's obligation to pinpoint when the discriminatory matter or personnel practice occurred, and it is the employee's responsibility to find some reason to extend that time. The appellee in this case, Mr. Miller, did not present any evidence to the district court that would allow the district court to extend the time beyond October 2001. The only evidence that Mr. Miller points to on his appeal is in an unverified complaint filed by his prior attorneys, which was not referenced at all to the district court, either in his opposition, his declaration, or the 200 pages of exhibits he filed. So there was no grounds before the district court on the motion to extend the time from the October 17th, 2001 date, which was the date conclusively established by emails that he knew of his non-selection for that budget officer position.
No, you keep saying that. But he acknowledges he knew when he wasn't selected. The question is, did he know who was selected? And until he knew that, he might not have had any grounds to allege discrimination.
I understand, Your Honor, but he didn't raise that before the district court that the time should be extended from when the personnel action occurred. And the personnel action here is his non-selection. That's the matter alleged to be discriminatory, is that they didn't select him.
Once he has the information, I mean, he didn't know a female had been selected. It's like that case, I can't remember which one it is, in the Seventh or Third Circuit, where the person is denied something on medical grounds and she tries to find out on what basis, and it's until she finds out what basis. She doesn't have any basis for thinking that there's discrimination.
I understand, but that issue wasn't raised before the district court to extend the time. He didn't even
understand when the district court says, I looked at the entire record in the case, and his opposition has the two declarations and his own declaration sworn.
Yes, Your Honor, and nowhere in those two declarations or his declaration describes when he learned of when a female was selected for the position. Those declarations only concern, even at its most generous reading, when he initiated EEO contact, not when he learned of his non-selection or the selection of a female.
But he says he didn't learn until December.
He says, his attorneys say, in an unverified clause mm-hmm. in a paragraph of the complaint that was unreferenced to the district court, that it was December. That was not before the district court on the motion, and it's unverified. It's unverified.
I agree, it wasn't verified, but it was before the district court. But it's not in any of those. I'm looking for his declaration.
Yes, Your Honor. His declaration.
No, I haven't. I'm just looking. Yeah. All right, so there's nothing in there as to when he learned.
When he learned. And again, it's his burden to show some reason to extend it beyond the matter alleged to be discriminatory to when he reasonably suspects. And that's in the context, that's in the text of the regulation, is that must initiate in the case of a personnel action within 45 days of the effective date of the action. And then clause 2 of the applicable regulation says that when the individual shows, that is his burden, that he or she did not know and reasonably should not have known that the discriminatory or personnel action occurred. So if he's using a justification to toll the start date, he must raise that before the district court. All the employer needs to establish in the first instance is that the discriminatory matter occurred or the alleged discriminatory matter occurred on X date. And we established that through his own emails that he knew of the discriminatory matter or the alleged discriminatory matter in October of 2001.
No, he knew he hadn't been selected.
Yes, and that is the discriminatory matter.
He had no grounds for thinking that there was discrimination at that point.
Well, he questioned the decision, and he didn't argue before the district court that he lacked grounds to make that allegation. And so if he's relying on a tolling provision, he has to raise it. and he didn't, even though he was represented by counsel both before his opposition was filed and 2.5 months before the decision on this case was issued before the district court, and no supplemental briefing or filing cert replies was requested, even though that fact wasn't raised at all in the briefing to the district court. Moving to the issue of when he initiated EEO contact, and as Judge Brown correctly pointed out, on three different places in the record, it's cited in the brief, he identifies January of 2002 as his date for participating in EEO activity for subsequent retaliation claims. In the course of preparation for this argument, there's actually two more places where he talks about that, and that's in his administrative complaint beginning at Joint Appendix 453, and the pinpoint site is Joint Appendix 458, where he identifies January 2002 as the date that precipitated retaliatory acts and says, since I previously filed an EEO complaining in January of 2002. His formal EEO complaint in this case was not until March of 2002, so if he identifies any complaint in January 2002, it must be his informal complaint, i.e. when he initiated EEO counseling. Furthermore, in his amended administrative complaint at Joint Appendix 471, he also indicated January 2002 was the date of the counseling session. That goes with the three other references to January of 2002, namely the EEOC's OFO decision and his initial and amended complaint in Miller 1. Furthermore, nothing in the declaration describes any intent to begin the EEO process, which is what the EEOC has defined as what constitutes initiate contact with a counselor. It talks about discussions with Ms. Guest, but Ms. Guest is the EEO director. She's there to help people. She's there to provide information on the process, and indeed she provided him repeatedly information on the EEO complaint process, as he concedes in his declaration. She's there to talk with employees about, you know, what issues they're facing and whether or not the EEO complaint process is perhaps the best way to go about it. But there's nothing in the declaration that says that he expressed an intent to begin the EEO process prior to January of 2002. Further, his request for
Well, why do you think he was talking with her? To take her out?
Well, he was talking with her about the issues, but there's one thing to talk about the issues, another to express an intent to begin a complaint process. The two are different.
The only reason you would go to talk to the head of EEO, he says he talked to her about continuous discrimination. That's what he alleges.
That's what he claims in his declaration. But it's one thing to say to the EEO director, who's there to help employees, look, I think I'm being discriminated against. What can be done? She hands him the form saying, this is the complaint process. You can do this. Or perhaps you should talk with your supervisors to talk further about that. And indeed, from the record, from the email traffic, we know that he continuously talked to his supervisors about his disgruntlement with their decisions regarding the non-selections. So it doesn't necessarily mean that he was going to talk to her to express an intent to initiate the EEO process, which is required under the regulation to stop the exhaustion clock. On the discovery request, there was no discovery request to the district court. The parenthetical in taken out of context in one paragraph of his declaration is not a 56F request. Counsel, although, again, they appear more than 2.5 months before the decision on this motion was reached, didn't make that argument to the district court, didn't file a motion for 56F relief or anything like that. Unless there are further questions, the appellee asks that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Quickly, so with respect to the count one issue and whether the question was, but this evidence was before the district court regarding Mr. Miller's awareness of a female being selected. That was actually the paragraph of the complaint where that's raised was cited by the NTSB in the reply brief. So Mr. Miller alleged that he didn't have a basis. NTSB did not submit any facts that would controvert that he was aware.
It's only the allegation in an unsworn complaint, and then the government files its motion. Mr. Miller files his opposition.
Yes.
And he never provides this salient fact under oath. on which the court could ground a basis for tolling?
Well, having alleged that he did not have a reasonable basis to suspect discrimination until December 2001.
That's in his complaint.
That's in his complaint. The NTSB does not submit any facts that, even if accepted, controvert that he was aware of that fact prior to December of 2001.
Their argument is it's his burden to demonstrate a basis for tolling.
Our view would be that under the summary judgment standard, with the court having, with Mr. Miller having alleged this, and the NTSB not submitting any facts that would dispute it, that he has met his burden with respect to that. And there's not a question that it wasn't that fact wasn't before the district court, since it was raised by the NTSB in their reply. In any event, the argument with respect to the the dispute with respect to counts one and two, and Mr. Miller's when Mr. Miller initiated contact applies with respect to both of those counts, and even if Mr. Miller was aware of, had a reasonable basis to suspect discrimination as of October 2001, he contends that his contact with Ms. Guest was continuing through that November-December 2001 period. Also, with respect to with respect to whether Mr. Miller conceded these points, those are similar instances where the discussion is regarding Mr. Miller's contact with the EEO counselor when that actual formal process began, not with respect to when he actually initiated contact with Ms. Guest.
So the district court, in granting the motion, says your client failed to, she doesn't say details, but provide any. Just get the language used. This is at JA 407, where the court says, nowhere in plaintiff's opposition to defendant's motion does he provide any facts that substantiate his assertions. And his assertions are what he's alleging in his complaint.
Yes, I think that the statement in the memorandum or the opinion there is more with respect to his is specifically with respect to his assertions regarding when he initiated EEO contact, and that he certainly addresses those in his declaration that he submitted in opposition to the NTSB's summary judgment filing. The district court did not address.
So he put in his sworn statement and the two co-employees' sworn statements that he'd been having these contacts with the head of the EEO office.
Yes, and that he had pushed, he uses the language, I pushed her to move forward, which.
Right. And then what we have on the other side is Mrs. Guest saying, well, here's my standard operating procedure, even though I don't have any knowledge about precisely what happened in this case.
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.